So good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our teleseminar on Working the Motivation Puzzle. Dr. Bethany Tucker is with us today, and she'll be talking about the person's desire to succeed is kind of similar to a jigsaw puzzle and what all those different pieces are and what the different factors are, and she'll help us with some mental models of motivation and strategies for developing people's intrinsic need to achieve. So during the call, since right now everyone is muted because we have a large number of people on the call, and we want to just cut down on background noise and make it enjoyable for everyone. So, but if you have a question during the call that you'd like to ask Dr. Tucker, please just email us at questions@ahaprocess.com, and that's questions with an S on the end at ahaprocess.com, and I will pose those to Dr. Tucker when we get to the question and answer time. And let me get right into introducing Dr. Tucker. Dr. Bethany Hamlet Tucker of North Carolina has been a professional educator since 1972. She has served as a classroom teacher, a resource teacher, a teacher of gifted students, a program coordinator, grant fund project director, and she's currently professor of education at Everett University in Danville, Virginia. While teaching at Everett, she researched and developed Tucker Signing Strategies for Reading, which is a decoding method using sight, sound, and movement that has been highly successful with struggling readers nationwide, as well as in some foreign countries. And she's also an experienced consultant, and Bethany has presented numerous workshops for AHA Process on the under-resourced college student, on reading, a framework for understanding poverty, learning structures, under-resourced learners, and motivation, which she has been studying and presenting on over the past couple of years. If you'd like more information on what Bethany is talking about today, please just email us. Again, you can email us at that questions@ahaprocess.com, or you can always call us at 800-424-9484. And Bethany is available for consulting and workshops at your organization. So if anything that she's talking about today, you think, ooh, I want more of that, just give us a call and we'll be happy to connect you with Bethany. Bethany, I'm dying to hear about motivating myself and others. So please, if you don't mind, let's get started.
Thank you. This has been a very fascinating study. I would like to share very quickly how I became interested in this topic. Well, over the past several years, I have conducted workshops on a framework for understanding poverty, and more recently, understanding and engaging under-resourced college students. More often than not, at the conclusion of one of my workshops, a college instructor would ask, how do we motivate our students? And some would even make the statement, why aren't they just motivated? And these are good questions. And I realized that although the work that we were presenting did address the issue, I didn't have a mental model of what motivation looks like in my head. So I began to research the topic, and in all honesty, I was looking for the key that would unlock the doors to motivation. And the more I researched, the more I realized there is no such key. In fact, I began to realize that the spider's web went in many directions, and I began to feel as if I was working a puzzle. And I did come to realize that helping to enhance one's own motivation or the motivation of someone else is indeed similar to working a puzzle. Therefore, those of you who have the slides, who were able to download the slides that David sent this morning, are looking at the first slide, solving the motivation puzzle, and you simply see puzzle pieces. The good news is that babies are born with all of the pieces, under most circumstances, with all of the pieces that are required to work the motivation puzzle and for a person to be motivated throughout life. Researchers have talked for decades about what these puzzle pieces are, and we're familiar with Maslow and some others who list these intrinsic needs and desires that we all have. And these are the needs and desires that encourage us, that enhance our motivation. Lists include acceptance, curiosity, survival, family, honor, independence, etc. So we have the pieces. The pieces are there. That's the good news. And the good news is also the fact that when we try to enhance a person's motivation, when we direct that enhancement, when we direct the feedback toward a person's tendencies, these internal tendencies, then this is the most effective motivation. This is more effective than trying to give rewards, etc. And if we know what a person needs at a particular time, if I'm really seeking acceptance, and if someone is trying to motivate me, if they address that my need for acceptance, then this would be the number one motivator. It's really interesting to read about the fact that we, as educators, social workers, whatever our position might be, we tend to think in this decade that about motivation in terms of intrinsic motivation. And we tend to say, well, people should just be motivated. Interestingly, until the 1940s, this was not the case. Until the 1940s, when we thought about motivation, people thought about extrinsic motivation. And it wasn't until Professor Harlow decided to reward some monkeys for working a puzzle and discovered that these monkeys picked up the puzzle and wanted to work it even without a reward. And the researchers were fascinated. It was at this point that they began to talk about internal or intrinsic motivation, because these monkeys did not need to be rewarded. They were just acting on curiosity. So for those of you who have the slides, if you'll flip to the second slide, you will see a picture of a table. And the reality is that although a person is born with the needs and desires that can enhance motivation, these pieces of a puzzle cannot be worked in a vacuum or in thin air. They have to be dumped onto a tabletop. And our intrinsic needs are in an environment. And we all know that not all environments are created equal. We know that these growth tendencies that we have are natural, but this does not imply that they operate robustly under all conditions. Instead, these inherent tendencies require support and nutrients from a social environment. So there are people whose puzzle pieces are dumped into an environment that do not support growth. For example, verbal abuse, emotional insecurity, or conditions that could exist in an environment, disrespect, can actually thwart the growth of intrinsic motivation. A tabletop must be predictable. People who live in an environment where they cannot predict what will happen one day, from one day to the next, or from one minute to the next, will not continue to feel intrinsically motivated to be curious, for example. They must be in an environment where they feel accepted. And when we think about this environment, again, when we think about extrinsic motivation, we tend to think about rewards. But rewards are such a very, very small part of extrinsic motivation. Extrinsic motivation exists all around us. But rewards, again, are a very small piece of this. In fact, rewards can actually extinguish intrinsic motivation. The researchers who were working with the rhesus monkeys decided that although the monkeys were already intrinsically interested in solving the puzzle, they decided to go ahead and reward the monkeys to see if they could encourage them to work the puzzles more quickly. They did. They gave them raisins. The monkeys improved their performance. But interestingly, when the experiment ended and the rewards ceased, the monkeys put the puzzles down and never worked them again. And what we discovered, what they discovered, was the fact that when we reward a person or a monkey or an individual for a behavior that already exists. Sometimes we can actually extinguish that behavior. I began to read other research studies. There are studies that show that young children who were rewarded to draw pictures with markers would draw pictures, and they would draw them very hurriedly in order to get their reward. And then when they were no longer rewarded, they stopped. And who can imagine a four-year-old who does not want to draw a picture with a marker? Well, these little children who had been rewarded and suddenly were not rewarded any longer were not interested. I experienced this myself. A few years ago, I was helping Dr. Payne, Ruby Payne, to develop some simulations, and I had a 12-year-old niece who loved to, and in her words, play the teacher game, and she couldn't wait for a new simulation to be completed. But once I was behind schedule, and I called her, I said, "Kayla, I need someone to play this game to see if there are any glitches." So she played the game. I said, "I will pay you $20. She played the game. I rewarded her with her $20. When the next one was available, I called her, "Kayla, there's a new game." She asked, "How much will you pay me?" I said, "Oh, nothing. It's just for the fun of it." She said, "I don't want to." So I had actually extinguished a behavior because it was already there. The research does tell us, however, that it is perfectly fine. In fact, it is a good idea to reward behaviors that are not yet established. It is good to reward people for specific mundane tasks. We've heard quite a bit lately about school districts paying students to perform well on a test. And what we discovered was that, yes, these students did want to be paid, and they found themselves working. But unfortunately, they didn't know what to do. They knew how to get to school every day. So if we reward students for being in school every day, they know how to do that. That is a very specific, mundane task. We discovered that rewarding students for showing up works. Paying them to do well on a test doesn't work as well because they simply don't know how. So again, specific, mundane tasks are appropriate for rewards. We also discovered that verbal praise directed toward intrinsic needs are the most efficient and most effective type of reward. So the things that we've been doing as educators and as social workers all along are indeed the most effective. Now, when we flip down to slide 3, what we're looking at on this slide is a box. And this is a puzzle box. And we know that when we purchase a puzzle, it has a picture on the top of the box. We wouldn't buy a puzzle that just has a blank top and we have to figure out what the puzzle pieces look like. That would be nearly impossible. But unfortunately, this is the way some of the people with whom we work are living their lives. They lack a future story. They lack goals. And if we want to give our people about whom we're concerned a gift, we could help them to develop a future story. But there is a catch. The catch is that if, for example, our goal is for this person to finish high school or to finish college, we must help them to develop a future story that includes graduation. A friend of mine told me recently that she knows a second grade teacher who asked her second graders to draw a picture of themselves 20 years in the future. She was trying to give them a future story. And that's, by the way, is one of the best strategies to use, to just have people of any age to sketch themselves in the future. Well, one little girl drew a picture of herself pole dancing, and obviously this was a future story that had been encouraged because likely she knew someone who was a pole dancer and made money. And that is fine. But what is missing from that picture, what is missing is the need to graduate. She doesn't necessarily have to have a diploma in order to pursue that particular occupation. So the teacher, recognizing the missing piece in that particular puzzle, looked at the child and said, "Oh, so you like music. What else could you do with music?" And the child said, I could teach music. The teacher said, that's a wonderful idea. And in order to teach music, you will need a high school diploma. So that will be one of our goals along the way. And earning a high school diploma became part of this child's future story. I have read in the research that avoidance goals are okay. If we have students who say, for example, I don't want to be in jail like my uncle. I don't want to get into trouble like somebody in my family. That's good. It's good. Avoidance goals are certainly better than approach goals toward a negative future. So we grab those avoidance goals and we run. But people who are acting strictly in response to avoidance goals often know that they're running away, but they don't know toward what. So our goal is to help them to develop a positive possible self. And we stress the word positive because we know that for our students and clients who live in poverty, we know that poverty is often a stressful world. And we say often, because nothing applies to everybody. But in some situations, poverty is stressful. We know that the divorce rate is higher in poverty, the abuse rate is higher in poverty, and poverty can, in some instances, become a negative world. And we work with people who see their future as a negative place. And our goal can be to help them to develop a future that is positive, and to put a positive spin on their future is something that we need to do. And something else that we can keep in mind, often I've heard teachers say, and I've said this also, that some of our students and some of our clients have such low aspirations, and this is hard to understand. But the research makes it very clear that none of us take 10 giant steps at a time. I, for example, would probably not be interested in becoming an astronaut going to another universe this afternoon. That would be too much of a giant step for me. And some of the students with whom we work, for some of these students, flipping burgers could be a promotion for their parents. And I talk during my workshops with teachers about the fact that we might be well advised to avoid saying, for example, if you don't work harder, you'll end up flipping burgers, because for some of their parents, flipping burgers could possibly be a promotion. In fact, if a student says, I want to flip burgers, that's a great goal. In fact, student, you might be able to be manager of Burger King someday. So let's take some business courses along the way as well. So we give them a future story, and we take them where they are and hopefully help them to develop a more in-depth future story along the way. And we build options. We realize that some of our students are very unaware of options in terms of future stories. So, again, if we can simply draw a picture on the top of this box, then we've given our students and clients a huge gift. And goal writing, of course, is a huge part of this as well, helping students to develop goals that are attainable and helping them to plan backward. And these are all topics that we can find in the literature, planning backward and goal development. Okay? If we look at slide 4, we see a picture, once again, of the table, but this time we're focusing on the 4 legs of the table. Tables need legs, typically 4 legs. Now, this tabletop on which the puzzle pieces have been dumped also needs legs. And as I studied motivation over the past 3 years, I began to realize that the support for this environment, this tabletop, the research can be categorized into 4 areas. According to what I've read, these 4 areas include autonomy, relatedness, competence, and growth. In other words, if we want to support a person's environment, we can provide or we can offer 4 things. First of all, we can offer autonomy. The research on autonomy is absolutely fascinating. What I have discovered is that this is the number one motivator. When people have the opportunity to choose a behavior, to choose a value, they're more likely to internalize the desired behaviors. Autonomy is indeed the number one motivator. Daniel Pink talks in his book about the M&M company that manufactures Post-it notes. Well, he shares the fact that this company decided years ago to allow their employees, starting with one day a week, to study whatever they wanted to work on one day a week. And it was during this free time, during this time that they could work on anything, that a group of their employees designed Post-it notes. It's their number one seller. It has saved the company. And they did this because they were free. One really interesting study is to read about a survey that's conducted in this nation annually. During the survey, people are asked to respond to questions. And from their responses, researchers determine which group is happiest, married men, married women, single women. And every year, the happiest self-reported group is that of married men. The reason being that married men often, and there are exceptions, of course, but married men often feel that they are in control of their lives more than the other groups. Of those four groups, married men, married women, single women, the group that self-reports to be least happy is that of married women. Again, they report this because that they sometimes feel that they don't have control of their lives. They feel responsible for other people. So what we want more than anything else is autonomy. And we could talk about how we could offer autonomy to the people with whom we work. And this particular category of study also points to the fact that this is one reason rewards do not work the way we think they would, because they often diminish the feelings of autonomy. If you tell me, well, if you do this, then you can do this, then I feel that I'm under your control. But if you offer me options, then I can feel autonomous and I can feel in control of my life. The second table leg is competence. If I do not feel competent, I do not feel motivated to try anything. If all of us, I'm not really sure how many people have dialed in, but if all of us were seated individually in cockpits of spaceships and we were told, look at all these buttons that are around us and their lights that are flashing. If we're told, press a button, and if you press the right button, you'll take off into space and it will be great fun. But if you press the wrong button, you will probably blow up. Few of us would dare to even press a button because we would lack competence. And some of our students, some of our clients just don't feel competent to accomplish the goals before them. This is where Ruby Payne's work of research-based strategies overlaps with the research on motivation so beautifully, because her research-based strategies have the goal of helping people to gain a sense of competence. She points out that often if a student fails a class, we have them retake the class, and sometimes the student is failing again and drops out. If, however, instead of having them simply take the test or retake the class, we teach them how to organize, we teach them how to sort what is important from what is not important, we teach them how to focus, then we're giving them a sense of competence. And if I feel competent, I will more than likely be motivated to at least try to accomplish a goal. The fourth table leg is labeled relatedness. There is a huge amount of research related to relatedness. Again, this overlaps with Dr. Payne's work as well. And she talks quite a bit about relationships of mutual respect and the fact that relationships of mutual respect require high expectations, insistence, and support. But there are many, many studies related to relatedness, studies that talk about bias, how we as individuals sometimes look at other people through bias, through biased eyes. Research talks about how human beings base as much as 80% of our expectations of other people on appearance. And if I'm a student and I have a teacher who doesn't expect me to do as well as the others, I sense that. I know that. And that damages our relationship. There's a great deal of research about voices and how we can talk to other people and maintain mutual respect. So, again, there's a great deal of research in this area, and some of this research deals with student relationships with their peers. It is important for students to have positive relationships with teachers, but they need relationships with their peers as well. In fact, students can learn more in some instances from a peer than they can learn from their teachers. And students also need to feel related to the community. So, and this is where we could talk more about hidden rules, because if I don't know how to behave in a particular community, if I don't know the rules, if I don't have the social skills, then I have little chance of being successful in that community. So, again, we could talk about faculty-student interaction, student-student interaction, and student-community interaction. The next table leg is related to growth. And growth, if I'm going to grow in an area, I need to feel related to that topic. And this is where we can help students to feel related to the topic that we're teaching. Moving on, when we go to the fifth slide, we see an almost completed puzzle. And an almost completed puzzle has edges and corner pieces. And the corner pieces of a person's identity that define what that person will look like include, according to the research, areas related to self. These areas related to self are self-confidence, self-competence, self-awareness, and self-regulation. I need to feel competent in order to be successful. One of the most interesting topics is that of self-awareness. As I read about self-awareness, I could not help but think about The Wizard of Oz. The Wizard of Oz, the movie, the book, describes self-awareness. We know that there was a character who said, "If I only had a brain." And some of the people with whom we work don't understand their own thinking patterns. They don't understand that intelligence grows. Some people, unfortunately, some students, some adults, have heard all of their lives that they're not capable. Some have even heard, you know, you're dumb. And when we hear this day after day or year after year, we begin to believe it. And these people are unaware of their ability, of their own thinking patterns. So the Wizard of Oz character needs to understand that they do have a brain and that their brains can grow. In fact, one effective strategy when you're working with people who have a negative self-concept and are unaware of their own abilities, if they say, for example, "I can't do this," an effective strategy is to say, "Repeat what you just said, but add the word yet at the end. I can't do this yet," so that they can understand that they can reach that goal. They can become capable of accomplishing that task. So just have them, again, repeat the sentence and then say yet. I can't do this yet. I don't know this yet. Another strategy that we can use when people say, I don't know, is to ask them, well, what would you say if you did know? And often they'll tell you the right answer. If you did know the answer, what would you say? More often than not, people have the answers in their heads. They have the information that we're seeking, but they're insecure about it. They won't share it. And we can simply say, okay, if you did know it, what would you say? Another character in The Wizard of Oz said, if I only had courage. The lion thought he lacked courage, but as we know, he was the most courageous person in the show, and we can help people to recognize their own strengths. Another character in that book said, if I only had a heart. So this encourages us to know our own emotions. We can talk about emotions, hope, pride, enjoyment, joy, anxiety, and we can talk with people about the fact that, you know, these are normal. And we can talk about the fact that failure is normal. Some people interpret failure as meaning that they're not capable. But if we can help them to understand that failure is normal, then they will be more courageous and they will be able to make some progress. The main character in that book, of course, was Dorothy. And Dorothy kept singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. She didn't know that she could be motivated right there in her own backyard. And this is another message that we can give to people, helping them to learn what does motivate them. The fourth corner piece is self-regulation. And those of you who dialed in to this teleseminar, dialed in for a purpose, you dialed in because you said to yourself, well, I can probably listen to this for an hour, or I really want this information, and you set aside the time. You regulate your day. Some people don't do that. And part of this is because often in poverty, people are treated like possessions. And if I am treated like a possession for long enough, I begin to think of myself as a possession. And I lose sight of the fact that, you know, I have control over my life. I have control over what I do. If I think of myself as a possession, I wait for other people to tell me what to do. And I'm afraid to act without them. Someone else telling me what to do. So this is another message that we can give to people. And we can help them to analyze rewards. We can talk about procrastination. We can talk about how we reward ourselves. We say to ourselves, you know, if I finish this task, then I can have a cup of coffee. And we reward ourselves, and some of the students and clients with whom we work have not experienced self-reward. Now, when we think about a table, we realize that the table legs might not all be level. And Dr. Payne's work about developing resources is what can level a table leg. If we work with someone who is not emotionally strong, for example, we can try to help build that person's emotional resource. So if you're interested in more work on or more information about resources and how these resources can help to level the table legs, then Dr. Payne's work is the resource for that. Now, the final slide talks about discarding puzzle pieces that don't fit. We all know that sometimes we try to work a puzzle, and lo and behold, someone has thrown in a piece that simply does not fit. And this is the way it is in life. Sometimes people learn helplessness, for example. A fascinating piece of literature deals with elephants, grown elephants, who weigh over a ton, can be held in zoos or circuses by a rope. And we look at them and wonder, why don't they just break the rope and run? Because they could. They could pop a chain if they wanted to. But we're told that when these elephants are babies, they are tied around their foot by a rope. And when they're a small baby elephant, they can't break the rope. And they tug and they tug and they suddenly realize, I can't break this, and they give up. This little elephant has learned to be helpless. So then when they're grown, even though they could, with very little effort, break that rope, they quit trying. And individuals do this as well. And some of the people with whom we work have learned to be helpless. And part of what we can do for these people is to identify this for them and to help them work through it. Another puzzle piece that does not fit is that of self-handicapping. During the intro, someone said, I've been in education for 1972, and that is beginning to sound like ancient history. But this means that I watched cowboy movies during the 50s. And I remember one cowboy movie in particular. A cowboy was scheduled to be engaged in a gunfight later that day, and he was afraid. So he simply shot himself in the arm, and then he appeared for the gunfight with his arm in a sling. There was bleeding, and, of course, no gunfight took place. And this is self-handicapping, and we work with people who will literally self-handicap. Students who will engage in alcohol or drug abuse, and then they can say, well, no, there's no wonder that I failed the test. I was not well that day. I had a hangover. And this is deliberate self-handicapping. And again, one of the best things that we can do to help students, clients, to understand how to work with the problem is to help them to understand what the problem is. People self-handicap, but they don't know they're self-handicapping. They have learned helplessness, but they don't know that they have learned to be helpless. There are also puzzle pieces pertaining to procrastination, and there are strategies that we can use, starting with simply talking about procrastination. But there's an interesting study dealing with children and marshmallows, and the study tells us that procrastination is built on a lack of trust, often, not always, but sometimes. Children were given marshmallows or one marshmallow on a plate individually, and they were told, you may either eat this marshmallow now, or you may wait 15 minutes, I'll bring you a second marshmallow and you'll have two. But if you eat this one now, you don't get a second one. Some of the children would gobble the marshmallow down, and when they were asked why didn't they wait for a second one, they said, I did not believe that you would really bring me another marshmallow. So trust is a huge issue, and procrastination is often behind a lack of trust. If I don't believe that I will get my reward that you promised, I am not motivated to actually get started. Another puzzle piece that needs to be discarded is stereotype threat. I'm sure the majority of you are too young to remember some of the stereotype threats. When I was a child, during the 50s, if I had ever said, I want to be a doctor when I grow up, likely the response would have been, you can't be a doctor, you're a girl. And this is what girls often heard. And therefore, there are few physicians my age who are women. Unfortunately, there are stereotype threats related to race and ethnicity. Unfortunately, we see TV programs where characters will say, well, that's white talk. And the message that we need to get to our students is that, you know, that this is formal register. It's the talk that is expected in a formal setting. I'll never forget, a few years ago, I was teaching reading on an Indian reservation, and I was making progress with a particular child. and this little girl read a word, and she was so happy. I suddenly noticed that children around her were calling her an apple. I didn't know what was going on, but I later learned that they were saying to her, you're red on the outside and you're white on the inside. This is why they called her an apple. And unfortunately, she was the victim of stereotype threat. They were saying that you're learning white language. And again, the message is, this is not white language, this is language of success. And we simply help to reframe their world. Ruby Payne's work talks quite a bit about reframing. We all view the world through a framework that has been built for us. We didn't build our own framework. Other people built it for us. I remember a few years ago I was upset with someone and gossiping and complaining about that person and, you know, what a bad thing that person was doing. And someone asked, well, how long have you known this person? I said, 15 years. And the response was, well, if you've been around this person for 15 years and this is still going on, somewhere along the way, you bought into it. And it's just as much your fault as it is the other person's. This person with whom I was talking had reframed my world, and this is what education is all about. Ruby Payne also tells the story of a principal who had trouble with a student, a high school student, almost on a weekly basis for fighting. One day, this principal said to the student, I need for you to sit down and watch a movie with me. In the movie, the movie was about Michael Jordan. During the movie, he was deliberately pushed into the bleachers by a member of the opposing team. But he didn't fight. He got up and he got back into the game. The principal asked the student, what did Michael Jordan do? Did he fight? No. Well, what he did that take strength? Yes, it did. The principal then asked, can you be Michael Jordan strong? And this helped to reframe the student's world. So when we see puzzle pieces that don't fit, our task can be that of reframing the situation for the student so that they simply see it differently. Okay, that's a brief overview. What we've talked about is a mental model for motivation. Again, when I first began to research the topic, I found myself reading in many, many, many areas, and I couldn't clearly in my head fit those pieces together until I was able to, for myself, develop this mental model of puzzle pieces. These are the intrinsic desires with which people are born, the tabletop, which is the environment onto which the puzzle pieces are dumped, the picture on the top of the box, which is the future story. Without a future story, I lack motivation to be challenged. The four legs, autonomy, relatedness, competence, and growth. The four corners, self-confidence. And by the way, we failed to mention that self-confidence is the most difficult corner to rebuild. Once self-confidence has been diminished, then it's very, very difficult to restore a sense of self-confidence. The other three are self-competence, self-awareness, and self-regulation. And self-competence is different in many respects from self-confidence. I can be a very confident person, and yet I know that I am not competent to pilot a rocket ship. And that's okay. It does not damage my self-confidence. But if I lack confidence, then when I suddenly realize I'm not competent in a certain area, this only enhances these negative feelings that I have about myself. And finally, discarding pieces that do not fit into the box. So this is a mental model that works for me. This gives me a mental image of motivation. It gives me a way to think about it. And when I read new topics, then I have a slot in which to fit those topics. It is now 1:15, so I will stop here for questions. Are there questions that have been sent in?
Let's see. I don't have any questions, but we have gotten a couple of comments about people who are wanting to listen to the recording again. So I'll just mention to everyone that the link for the recording of this teleseminar will be in next month's newsletter, in the December newsletter. Bethany, this is great information. I keep thinking about how it relates to myself, how it relates to my kids. And you've given such a great mental model. I love this because it really does pull everything together.
Right.
If you've got we'll wait again for, if you've got a little bit more to tell us, I'll just remind everyone that if they do have questions, to email that to us at questions@ahaprocess.com. It's questions with an S on the end. And we will pose that to Bethany while we're online. So do you have any more tidbits for us, Bethany?
Oh, absolutely. I could talk about this for hours. The research is so fascinating. I think back to the research about rewards, because there's a great deal of research about rewarding individuals, and most of the research says maybe we shouldn't, or if we do, we should proceed very cautiously. I didn't mention the fact that rewards can actually diminish creativity. There are studies describing artists who were given material, given time to just paint. Just paint whatever you want to paint. And their products were displayed. Then they were commissioned to paint. And those products were displayed. And the two displays were evaluated. And the judges overwhelmingly gave higher ratings to the paintings that were completed when the artists were just painting for the joy of painting. Their ratings for the commissioned pieces were much, much lower because, similar to the research that we described earlier, rewards can, in a sense, diminish a sense of creativity. Another study that comes to mind dealt with children playing with toys. Children were literally rewarded for playing with certain toys in a particular experiment. After the experiment ended, the children refused to touch those toys because they felt in a sense, well, if I had to be paid to play with these toys, then they must not really be any fun after all. So they chose not to play with the toys. And this reminds us that if those of us who are educators, if we're thinking to reward students to do their homework, we would reward them for putting that piece of paper in the basket. But we would not reward them for doing math. Because once the reward stops, we can say, now, you know how to put your paper in the basket. You've been doing it all year, and that's okay. But if we say, now, continue to do your math, they suddenly think, well, math must not be any fun because they had to pay me. So what the research says that we should consider doing is reward, once again, mundane activities, but try to avoid associating that activity with a discipline or with a subject because they suddenly start thinking, well, this must not be a very fun subject after all, and they stop engaging in it. So I will pause here to see if there are questions at this point.
Yes, let's see. What are some strategies for rebuilding students' confidence and helping students work through learned helplessness and self-handicapping?
Okay, thank you for that question. For rebuilding a sense of confidence or building a sense of confidence from scratch, a very effective strategy is to identify something that the person can do and then say, if you can do this, then you can do this. For example, a student might say, well, I can't pass this test. If that student has a driver's license, we can say, if you can get your driver's license, then you can pass this test because passing a test for a driver's license is much more difficult than passing this test. So that is one of the number one strategies for building confidence. And building confidence takes time. Now, another piece of research is related to attributions. Often, when people lack confidence, and this is also related to learned helplessness and self-handicapping, often people who don't have the sense of confidence will attribute their successes and their failures to something over which they have no control. Oh, I failed that test. I just had bad luck. I passed that test. I was lucky. And see, that luck is something over which they have no control, and they're doing this to protect their own sense of worth. But if we say to them, do you know what? I think you passed that test because you're competent and you worked hard, then that is helping to build that sense of confidence and to help them to avoid self-handicapping and becoming a victim of learned helplessness in the future. One of the most effective expressions that we can use with students to, in terms of feedback to help them to become more confident is to say, I think you passed that test because you're competent and you worked hard. It had very little, if anything, to do with luck. And when they fail again, we can say, do you know, I understand you didn't do as well on this test as you wanted to, and I understand that you studied. So let's find another strategy that you can use for studying, because you can do this. You can do this if you find the right way to study. Or if they didn't study, we can say, quite honestly, you failed this test because you didn't study well. You didn't study enough, or you didn't study at all. So helping people to learn to attribute their successes and failures to themselves rather than to external factors can help them to become more confident. And I know I've said this twice, but I'll say it the third time. The most effective feedback we can give is, you were successful. You passed this. You did great because you're competent and you work hard. You worked hard. You studied hard. And we can say, you know what? Your effort paid off. Good job. This can help to build that sense of confidence. Again, there are many topics about which we can read. The use of the adult voice, for example, can help to build confidence. But confidence is built through positive feedback. Rewards can actually extinguish a sense of confidence. I hope that was clear.
Sounded clear to me. Bethany, I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more about autonomy and how that plays in.
Okay, thank you. Autonomy in a school setting would look like this. It would look like a syllabus that says choose two of these three projects, or for your exam, answer one of these three questions. For younger children, it would be very similar. Here are two projects. These are two questions you can answer. You choose. Here are two animals you can study. You choose the one that you want. If our lines were not muted and we as individuals could share an experience that we had in school or in college that was meaningful for us, many of us would share an experience that included a sense of autonomy. When I think back to the courses that I took, I'll never forget taking psychology, and we were allowed to choose a particular theory to study and to present. I developed a mental model for that particular theory. I enjoyed studying the theory. I enjoyed presenting it. And it was my enjoyment, 90% stemmed from the fact that I had the opportunity to choose the topic. In the workplace, we can offer autonomy in terms of hours that we work, with whom we work. I was fortunate enough a number of years ago to be able to spend a few years working with students who were identified as gifted and talented. We had no curriculum. The children in the fourth grade appeared every Monday, fifth graders every Tuesday, etc. No curriculum. They chose their topic of study. These students chose topics such as, one young man said, I want to know more about the kind of hemlock that Socrates used for committing suicide. And I probably have all of this wrong because what the young man studied was well over my head. I had another student who studied animals, and she helped a veterinarian to operate on a camel. These students kept us running because they were able to choose the topic that they studied. It was really quite fascinating. I could go on with this topic as well, but I'll stop there to see if I need to go in another direction now.
Yes, we've got another question, and it's how to convince teachers that students cannot change this behavior on their own. Most teachers think the lack of motivation is purposeful or defiance, like especially at the high school level.
That's a really interesting point. And I learned quite a bit from Ruby Payne's work about driving forces. And her work on driving forces can help to answer this question. If I am from a household where no one works, or if we live on compensation or pension or any other source of money, work does not become a driving force in my life. And I will not be motivated to work. A student, a child who has been told all of their lives, well, you don't have to work, is not motivated to work. And our task becomes that of creating driving forces for the students. So part of the message to educators is just this. Some of our students have driving forces that are not the same as ours. That does not mean that we say, okay, let it go, but we can find ways to help for that person to develop a driving force that includes work, that includes achievement. Because if I am living in the survival mode, if I'm living in the tyranny of the moment, as many people in poverty are, I'm only worried about making it through the day. I don't think about the future. If, however, I'm from an environment where people are motivated to achieve, then I am motivated to try to do well, to succeed. A person who lives in an environment where that is not part of their world has no reason to be motivated to achieve. And through all of these puzzle pieces and through the tabletop and through autonomy, for example, through developing a self-confidence, we can help this person to create a picture for the top of that puzzle box so that achievement is part of their future story. And back to the original question, how to get this message across to teachers. What I have discovered is that it takes a discussion. And when I conduct workshops on a framework for understanding poverty or working with under-resourced college students, we pause and we have this question and we talk about the fact that our students are viewing the world through a framework that other people built for them. They did not build it themselves. And education is all about reframing the world. And our students who lack motivation to achieve need for their worlds to be reframed. And that's our job.
Right. We have another question. And the question is, what are your suggestions when talking to early childhood teachers to help them understand motivation, I guess?
Okay. That's a good question, and research tells us, well, there are many, many things that we could talk about here, but two of the most important points that are made are to help young children to see themselves as an individual person. Often in poverty, little children, again, are treated like possessions, and if what young children need to here is that they need to be talked to, and they need to be told, you are a person. You make your own choices. And when a child begins to see himself as an individual, that child can move toward motivation. a child who is constantly told, sit down, or heaven forbid, you're dumb, that child learns to self-handicap. That child fails. That child's intrinsic puzzle pieces are thwarted. So these are the major messages that when we mediate young children, part of mediation is simply engaging in conversations with them and helping them to see themselves as competent individuals.
Wonderful, Bethany. Well, thank you so much. Those are all the questions that we have time for. Although if you think of something in an hour or so and think, oh my gosh, I wish I had asked Bethany that, Bethany has graciously offered to continue to answer questions today if you send them to us, again, at questions@ahaprocess.com. If you've got any other questions about what Bethany is able to present at conferences or workshops, please go ahead and you can email us that as well. You can tell that she's an amazing presenter, and you may just want to bring her to your location. So thank you so much, Bethany, for sharing all this information with us.
It was my pleasure.
It's been terrific. And thank you, everyone, for taking the time out of your day to join us. We look forward to gathering again next time. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.